Welcome to Sound Off 117 here on SEScoops.com for Saturday, July 17th, 2010. Thanks, as always, for downloading the podcast. Of course, you can follow the Solid Monster on Twitter at twitter.com/SolidMonster and on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSolidMonster. So check me out on there. Lots to talk about this week. WWE, TNA, a couple of other miscellaneous notes here on this this week's edition of the Sound Off. And I'd be remiss if I did not begin. I know we have a WWE pay-per-view coming up, Money in the Bank, tomorrow night. But I want to talk about TNA first, and then we'll get to WWE stuff. Now, the talk of the week coming out of the Impact tapings earlier in the week, because TNA, of course, taped the next, I guess it was at least the next 2 weeks, is already taped in the can. And coming out of the Monday night tapings, we had a huge angle that we had heard about from the spoilers regarding an extreme invasion, if you will, the end of the show. A show-closing angle, not unlike the NXT angle that took place on Raw last month with John Cena, which got a lot of people talking and renewed a lot of interest in the product, at least until recently. I think some of that's died off. But nonetheless, TNA trying their own invasion-type angles. Now, you know, if this was something they had planned for a long time or not, what I can tell you is that this particular angle, as it unfolded at the tapings, the way it went down, was not planned in advance. This all came together at the last minute, at least the way that it actually went down. I believe the original plan was to have some sort of former ECW guys against the current TNA wrestlers, and somewhere along the way, I guess Tommy Dreamer has had a hand in the creative process here with this angle, and it changed almost literally overnight to being all about ECW, and of course the pay-per-view coming up will be essentially the TNA version of WWE's One Night Stand. We'll talk about that in a second, but what a great angle is what everybody said, right? This is not what I'm saying, by the way. This is the comments that were coming out of the tapings from people who work for the company, from fans who attended the taping of the show at the Impact Zone. People were raving about the angle. This is great stuff. This is better. Better, they said, than the NXT angle. This is going to turn TNA around. Who needs Paul Heyman when you've got a hot angle like this? So they piqued my interest. And for the first time in a while, I wanted to try to go out of my way to watch Impact in full from start to finish and get a real feel for the show and check out the supposed great angle at the end of the program. Now, I wasn't around to see Impact when it first aired on Thursday, so subsequently I went on YouTube and I've kind of pieced the show together. I think there might have been one or two segments that I overlooked, but I basically have watched all the important stuff from Thursday night. And I can say this. The show itself, in my opinion, overall, top to bottom, start to finish, was, again, in my opinion, a pile of shit. It's the same old TNA stuff, a lot of stuff that just doesn't matter or doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, you take the good with the bad, but take the top 10 rankings, for example. I like the idea of using a ranking system. God knows I've harped on that long enough on this show, going back years. I wish WWE would implement something like that, but when there's no logic to it, then what's the point of having a top 10 ranking system? So, for example, Abyss is ranked number one in the top 10. He is the number one contender for Rob Van Dam's World Heavyweight Championship. Abyss. Why? I don't know. The Pope, D'Angelo De Niro, number nine in the top 10. Now, as I recall, the Pope has been out for quite some time with a shoulder injury. I believe it was a separated shoulder. He basically has no wins since, what, May? Maybe even April? He's number nine. Ahead, mind you, of the number 10 spot held by the global champion, Rob Terry. It's funny that Rob Terry is the global champion of TNA, and he's ranked number 10 in the top 10. Now, obviously, the world champion is higher on the totem pole than the global champion, so you have RVD is the world champion. And yes, he's way there, up there above Rob Terry, but that also means you've got nine other people in front of you, and you are the global champion. Can somebody please explain that to me? Hernandez? Number seven? I don't know. That just irked me when I first saw that. That got me off on a bad foot when it came to the show. But you know what? I'm willing to overlook that. And, you know, they had the women's action. You know what? I'll just talk about the good stuff on the show. The Motor City Machine Guns Beer Money Ladder Match, if anything, the only thing I could fault it for was that it was too short. It was such a good match, I wish it had another at least five, six, 7 minutes to it. I think it was just a shade under 10. Great match. Really enjoyed that match. But again, the Machine Guns and Beer Money, they've got a certain chemistry. They are the two best teams in TNA. The Machine Guns and Beer Money in WWE would vastly improve that tag team division. So if I were TNA, I'd hold on to those guys as long as possible. It's almost a crime, really, that the Machine Guns haven't had a run with the belts in all the time they've been in that organization until now. But what a great match that was. I really enjoyed it. Jeff Hardy and Jay Lethal, not so much. Why you would take that match and basically just give it out there without any sort of build or hype or anything like that. You know, Lethal, they're trying to push him. He just got a big win over Ric Flair. I don't know what's going on with Jeff Hardy of late. I had an up-close and personal little chat with Jeff myself a couple weeks ago, and physically it looks like he's, you know, let himself go a little bit. His ring work maybe has suffered because of it, but Jeff Hardy and Jay Lethal given away on TV with no build, less than 5 minutes. Jeff Hardy wins clean. I like clean victories. I'm not saying I wish that somebody would have run into the match and interfered or anything like that. I just thought the whole match was a colossal waste and, quite frankly, wasn't very good. And that's not Jay Lethal's fault either. Let's see. What else good can I say about Impact from Thursday? Not much. It was a shit show. And then we get to the main event. I'm sure all the TNA fanboys are just fuming right now, throwing furniture in their apartment because I said it was a shit show. The big angle. Abyss comes out, cuts a pro. Well, I mean, basically, the gist of it is this. A whole bunch of people ran out, and it was kind of comical to me because you had these, it was like these formations. Of course, TNA has that long ramp that connects to the ring, connects the ring to the backstage area. So you only have so much room, really, to run and to walk. And you had these formations. It was always like two guys would run down, then another two, then another two, then another two. And I'm watching this, and I'm thinking to myself, why does anybody even care? I'm seeing people run down to the ring, Nat Morgan or whoever. You know, why do these people give a crap that Tommy Dreamer is beating up D'Lo Brown? Who gives a shit? Why would these people care? I didn't quite figure that out. At least, you know, with the whole John Cena thing, when he got his ass handed to him by Nexus, you can at least make the argument that, well, I guess John Cena, quite frankly, is just not very well liked, which is partially a shoot, actually, with the other wrestlers backstage. But believe me, that angle has its own logic holes as well. But maybe the problem is this. So many people raved about this angle and told people to watch it. It's great. It's so much better than the NXT stuff, or at least it's on par with the NXT stuff. You're setting yourself up for failure. When that NXT angle was done that first night last month, it was so well done. It was so well received. It was so good. And part of it also, I mean, again, Raw is live, so they have the benefit of that, but nobody saw it coming. Nobody expected it. It was completely, it caught everybody off guard, which again, with wrestling these days, including WWE, is a rare thing. Things are so predictable and formulaic. That's part of what made that angle so great. With TNA, they've been teasing this shit for weeks. So you kind of knew it was coming. It was reaching a boiling point, which doesn't mean that when you kind of reach that climax, that the climax can't be good. It just, in my opinion, wasn't very good at all. And just to show that I'm not a complete TNA hater, I will say, and I even posted this on my Twitter page yesterday, that I thought the Riot angle, you may recall that angle that TNA did, I believe it was last summer, where it stretched out over, I think, two or three commercial breaks. You had wrestlers beating each other up in the backstage area, in the Universal Studios parking lot, in the ringside area, in the crowd. It was just complete and total chaos. The cops had to come break it up. I mean, which, it was a little hokey, but I thought that was far better than that shit that we got on Thursday night. Who possibly could have watched that and thought, man, this is really, really great? Especially if you saw the NXT angle. Now, if you judge this on its own merits and forget, let's say you're not a WWE fan or you didn't see the Nexus thing, you don't think the Nexus thing is that good, then maybe you give this a little more respect than I am. Maybe I don't have the benefit of that because I did see the Nexus angle and I am comparing it to it. I honestly think that even on its own, this just was not a very good angle. I can't say that it's one thing. You know, you can argue that it's a bunch of old guys. And maybe one thing I appreciated about the Nexus thing, for example, is that it's a bunch of young guys, you know, who you can actually buy as being these hungry, you know, bunch of rookies who are in pretty good shape going out there beating the crap out of people. You know, and at least they're making an attempt to put some of those guys over, because not everybody in Nexus is going to become a world champion one day. But could a Wade Barrett be a world champion? Absolutely. Daniel Bryan? Sure. Justin Gabriel? Maybe. Skip Sheffield, in my opinion, he's the dark horse. I look at Skip Sheffield, I think Batista, not just because of the physical build, because he's a big guy, but just nobody looked at Batista and said that Batista was going to come out of Evolution being a world champion before Randy Orton, but that's exactly, well, actually, Randy Orton technically was a world champion before Batista, but again, the plan was Orton was going to break, you know, really break out bigger than he did, and he was going to main event WrestleMania back in 05, and of course, Batista got that spot instead. But nonetheless, against Triple H. My point is this. Skip Sheffield, in my opinion, is a big star in the making, just as much as Wade Barrett is. Wade Barrett is a better talker. He's probably a better in-ring performer, but there's just something about Sheffield that just, I would watch that guy. But again, I'm getting off subject here. Back to the TNA angle. I didn't like it. I see Pat Kenny out there, the former Simon Diamond from the ECW days. And apparently Pat Kenny, who was an agent backstage in TNA, is going to be, I guess, on the quote-unquote ECW side. Obviously, they can't call themselves ECW. But Al Snow, who, of course, got over in ECW as being a nut job who walked around with a mannequin head, is taking the ECW side. Now, keep that in mind, because those of you who paid any attention to the very end of Impact on Thursday night, when Dixie Carter, and this is the one thing that really killed this angle dead for me, when Dixie Carter, who was sitting at ringside, grabs a microphone in a panic and says, "Stop." She's screaming, "Stop, stop, stop, stop fighting." She says, "I invited them." She invited the invaders. And, of course, everybody has this shocked expression on their face, including Al Snow, which puzzled me, because Al Snow is part of the quote-unquote ECW contingent. Why is he so surprised when Dixie Carter makes that comment? One of the last shots of Impact on Thursday night is Al Snow, a bewildered Al Snow, looking towards Dixie Carter, mouthing, "What?" That was stupid. I blame the TNA production manager or director for that one. Why you would put that on TV, I don't know. But Dixie Carter. God bless Dixie Carter. It's obvious that she's frustrated because she ain't getting Paul Heyman. And I got to tell you something. There's no way that Paul Heyman watches that show on Thursday night and thinks, "Man, I got to be a part of that. I have got to be a part of that." Do you remember the interview a couple weeks back that Dave Meltzer and Brian Alvarez did? Meltzer and Alvarez, they run the Figure 4 Online / Wrestling Observer website, and they were in Vegas for UFC 116. So they were there for this, you know, for the Brock Lesnar fight. Paul Heyman was there. The Rock was there. Austin, Goldberg. So after the show was over, Meltzer and Alvarez, who were pretty good friends with Heyman, actually got Heyman to do an on-camera 20-minute interview. And obviously, the subject of TNA came up during that interview. This was, what, 2 weeks ago? Two, 3 weeks ago. This wasn't that long ago. And when the subject of TNA came up, this is not just me saying that TNA is, for the most part, they book shitty television. Heyman basically himself said they book shitty television. I don't think Paul Heyman is watching the show that he watched, and I'm sure he must have watched it or heard about it by now, on Thursday, and wanting more to come into TNA than he was before. If anything, this would deter him completely from wanting anything to do with this company. It's no wonder he did not want to have any involvement in this angle, which is exactly what Dixie Carter tried to get him in for. She wanted him to be the on-camera leader of this rebelling faction. And obviously, this is Plan B. Plan B being Mick Foley. Mick Foley, I guess, and Tommy Dreamer are the de facto leaders now of this ECW faction. But where does Dixie Carter stand here? Obviously, she invited them. Why did she invite them? All I could think was this. When I saw Dixie Carter standing there saying that she invited the ECW contingent, it brought back some bad memories It brought back memories from one of the best angles I've ever seen on Raw that was killed in the same night. July 9th, 2001, Monday Night Raw. That was the night that ECW came back. You may recall that a bunch of ECW guys who were already working for WWE at the time came down to the ring when Tommy Dreamer and Rob Van Dam jumped in to attack Chris Jericho and Kane, as I recall. Dreamer and RVD, this was their debut appearance. They did a run-in. Okay, so here comes Taz and Raven and, you know, these former ECW guys, the Dudley Boys, who were already working for WWF, and everybody thinks, well, Dreamer and RVD are fucked now. And, of course, the ECW guys ended up banding together, beating up the WWE guys. Paul Heyman, who was sitting on commentary with Jim Ross, gets in the ring. This is exactly what Dixie Carter wanted for this angle. She wanted Heyman to get in there, to start cutting promos, and to lead these guys, just like he did back in 01. Now, you remember that as phenomenal as that angle was, not 1 hour later on the same Raw show, Stephanie McMahon was introduced as the quote-unquote owner of ECW. And that was it. Dead. I cannot think of anybody who liked the idea of Stephanie McMahon being the president or the owner or really having any affiliation at all, unless she was going to do a striptease like Kimona, having anything to do with ECW. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, by the way, probably YouTube, what was it, Kimona Wanalea. And you might find some interesting videos from the old ECW on there. But in any event, that's what Dixie Carter was looking for here. She didn't get Heyman, so I don't know where they're going as far as, you know, what's the logic behind this, if this is part of a long-term storyline. Of course it's not. Why am I even thinking that? So I see Dixie Carter, I think Stephanie McMahon, and that just brings back bad memories. Dixie fucking Carter should have absolutely nothing to do with anything relating to ECW. TNA should not be doing anything relating to ECW at all. WWE did one good thing with ECW. They put on two very good one-night stand pay-per-views. The 2005 show, the original one, being the far superior one. You know, a lot of people look at that 2005 show as being the real closure for fans of ECW and performers who worked for the original ECW. That was the closure they never got when the company went belly up, basically, back in 01. And 06 wasn't a bad show either, but there was more WWE involvement. There was something surreal when you think back to, you know, John Cena jumping into the lion's den to wrestle Rob Van Dam. That was a pretty damn good show itself. And that was it. We all know what happened after that. ECW on Sci-Fi was nothing like people were hoping. It turned to shit, and that was the end of that. So now it's 2010. TNA is not doing very well. TNA is on borrowed time if they don't really, really make some significant changes. Or get rid of some of those big contracts they added to their payroll in recent months. And so what do? They decide to go back to ECW, which is going to be interesting because they're really, you know, walking a fine line here as far as copyrights and things like that. You know, WWE would not hesitate to fuck with TNA whether they see them as a threat or not. They'll just fuck with them for the sake of fucking with them. You know, they'll wait until a week or two before their pay-per-view coming up, and then they'll say, well, you know, you can't do this because it infringes on our copyright. It's one thing for the announcers to name drop ECW here and there. It's an entirely different thing to start mentioning ECW on television. And I don't know if any of you, I'm sure some of you have read the Impact spoilers for next week. Although this is actually not announced there, but I'm reading now this morning that the name of the upcoming pay-per-view, which is supposed to be TNA Hard Justice on August 8th. They may actually be changing the name this year and calling it One Last Stand. So if you needed any further proof of TNA, you know, it's a shame because TNA, like I said, they have really good talent. They have some good ideas every now and again. I think that sometimes they are unfairly branded when people say, well, they're just copycats for WWE. This is not one of those times. This is a blatant ripoff of what WWE did. And you know what? I don't think this pay-per-view coming up can do any worse than some of the recent TNA shows that have dipped below. Believe it or not, TNA does not release these numbers. You know, it's unbelievable to think that a company like TNA that has national television exposure, they've been around for over 8 years, is still drawing pay-per-views of less than 10,000 people. I mean, think about this. Think about this for a second, okay? I got some stats here. Now, TNA does not publicly release their numbers. They stopped doing that a long time ago. It's no wonder why. But numbers are still out there to be found if you look hard enough. And there are people that have looked these numbers up. People that have done their due diligence, if you will. In demand, pay-per-view. Some of the recent shows, I believe the last two shows, not the most recent one, but the two before that. Less than 8,000 pay-per-view buys for each show. TNA, of course, privately claims that these shows do over 20,000. Bullshit! 20,000 is bad enough. 8,000 is a disaster. See, the way I look at it, this pay-per-view coming up cannot possibly do any worse. If anything, they may build enough intrigue, and maybe there are still enough old ECW fans around that maybe they could do 20 or 30,000 buys for this next show. I don't know. They're not going to do the 300 or 350 that WWE did for that first one-night stand. They're not even going to come close. But God bless them. I hope they do well. I hope they can recoup some of the money they've lost. But they're losing a lot of money. And this is certainly not something... Again, just to compare the two, unlike the Nexus angle, which has been a little bit of a ratings boost. You know, Nexus showed up on NXT this past week and bumped the rating up to a 1.1. I can't remember an NXT rating being that high in quite a while. Raw ratings have been up slightly. But more importantly, it's young guys that you would hope are going to come out of this, at least even if it's only one or two of them. You'll have some new stars, legit new stars made out of this. What are you hoping to accomplish with this angle? What purpose does this serve? How does this build TNA for the future? Tommy fucking Dreamer is the centerpiece of this angle. Okay, quick spoiler alert for you. On Impact next week, Tommy Dreamer is going to cut a promo with Dixie Carter where Tommy Dreamer is going to cry. Big surprise. Tommy Dreamer is going to cry, I know. Tommy Dreamer, in the midst of this brawl on Impact Thursday night, apparently got knocked off the stage by Brother Ray and tore the MCL in his knee. Now, Tommy Dreamer went on his Twitter and said he's hoping to keep his no-surgery streak alive. He's not going to have it operated on, not yet anyway. He's going to gut it through. Smart? No. But good for him. He knows, he thinks he's an important part of the angle, and he wants to be part of it. God bless him. I hope he's very... He seems happier now than he was in WWE. He's had a lot of input into this angle and how it's being worked. It was Dreamer's idea, apparently, for this next pay-per-view to be an all-ECWS pay-per-view. There will be no TNA talent as far as AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, Jay Lethal. Nobody's going to be wrestling and possibly even appearing on the show. It's going to be very much like the original WWE ECW one-night stand. I don't think the show will come anywhere close to being as enjoyable. Some of the performers on that original show, sadly, are no longer with us, but... I hope they put on a great show. I just don't see what purpose it serves. I don't see what good this does for the company. I don't really have any interest, quite frankly, in seeing guys who were old enough 5 years ago, let alone now it's 2010. I'm looking at Raven, and, you know, apparently Raven's cleaned himself up. You know, Raven has been in worse shape in the past. Good for him. He looked god-awful on Thursday night. I mean, he looked fucking terrible. Tommy Dreamer, first night in, tears a muscle in his knee. I mean, this is what you're dealing with here with these older guys. You know, Pat Kenny, I don't give a shit about Pat Kenny. I don't think anybody gives a shit about Pat Kenny. Who cares? The brawling, as people are fighting, it just looks so contrived. So phony, so fake. You know, yes, wrestling's fake, newsflash, I get that. But again, I just watched an invasion angle a month ago that felt... 100% more real to me and was far more intense than what I saw on Thursday night. And I got people emailing me and telling me, oh, did you, you know, people were saying this angle was so great on Monday night. This angle was not great. It wasn't even very good. Okay, and that's not because I'm biased against TNA. It's because the truth fucking hurts. That angle was no good on Monday night. Now, maybe Tommy Dreamer will come out on Impact next week and he'll cut an impassioned promo that will convince me that this is a good idea. I won't hold my breath, but maybe he will. But again, when you have Dixie Carter as a focal point, maybe not the focal point, but certainly positioning herself to be a focal point of this angle, I don't understand it. I just don't get it. I don't get why I'm supposed to be excited about this. What is the point? because Vince McMahon fucked around with ECW. Yeah, Vince McMahon killed ECW, but not before he allowed Paul Heyman and those people to put on a damn good show in 2005. You got your closure. I don't see where ECW fans have been clamoring for another return of ECW. You know why they're doing this? You know, I've talked before about those focus groups and those surveys that that Eric Bischoff talked about this before. You know, the great excuse that, you know, the reason TNA is no longer on Monday night is because the fans spoke. The fans obviously didn't want Impact to air on Monday nights. They wanted it back on Thursdays. Now, mind you, this neglects the fact that Impact, I think except for maybe 1 week, was always on Thursday nights, even when it aired on Mondays. You know, it was a replay, but Impact was still on Thursday. So by that logic, if fans just didn't watch Impact on Mondays because it was a different night, then your ratings on Thursday should never have gone down, which they did. Their ratings went down all around. Only now are they beginning to build their rating back up to where it was before. You know, before it was like, well, can TNA ever get above a 1.1 or a 1.2? And then the ratings took such a nosedive after their failed experiment. Believe it or not, we're at the point now where being back at a 1.1 is considered a success because you've recouped those fans you had before, but you've gained absolutely no new ones. It's just mind-boggling to me. So, anyway, this angle was lame. They're trying to get Jerry Lynn, apparently, in to face Rob Van Dam in the main event of this pay-per-view coming up, which would, I guess, reignite the old feud that the two of them had in ECW over 10 years ago. You know, I've seen Jerry Lynn wrestle in Ring of Honor. He's, you know, he can still go. I don't know if him and RVD are going to have a match quite on the level of the matches they had 10 or 11 years ago, but I'm sure they'll certainly try. This is not confirmed. Lynn has not signed a contract yet or anything like that, but that is what they're pushing for. So, and apparently they also announced that Kurt Angle will be facing Hernandez as he continues his chase through the top 10 to the World Championship. And I think they just casually threw it out there. I almost missed it, that Angle is putting his career on the line next week against Hernandez. I don't even think they gave it a graphic or any sort of, there was no promo or anything to build it up. It was just mentioned in passing, like nothing significant. So typical TNA. I'm not even going to spend really any time on the whole thing about Dixie Carter's backstage meeting before the tapings, which I'm sure you read about on SD Scoops. And if you haven't, shame on you. You should get on there and read about it. Basically, she had a backstage meeting with everybody. I believe it was on Monday. A lot of people thought that it would be some sort of news or announcement regarding Paul Heyman. She said not word one about Paul Heyman. Instead, she basically criticized her crew and said that they need to tighten up their ring work. This, mind you, coming off a pay-per-view that had a couple of really good wrestling matches and a lot of shitty booking. But apparently the wrestlers are to blame for their shitty TV shows. Just showing you further that this woman really just does not have a fucking clue what she's doing. Her adventures on Twitter, of course, continue as well. She had posted a couple of days ago something. She actually posted a tweet to the effect of, "Oh, you guys will never believe who I just met with, but you will soon," or something to that effect. That was Paul Heyman. Dixie met with Paul Heyman again because they've had meetings, and she was referring to Paul Heyman in that tweet. And again, she's tweeting about something without having a deal in place. I think at that point they hadn't even discussed money. They'd only discussed ideas. They don't have Paul Heyman. They're no closer to signing him now than they were a week or two ago. And if anything, they're further apart now because he probably saw that shitty angle from Thursday and has no interest in coming into this company. So again, they continue to post bullshit on Twitter and get people all amped up about something that probably is never going to happen. Let's tuck Money in the Bank. Not that this pay-per-view is any better. But WWE does have a pay-per-view this Sunday. Money in the Bank, of course, it has graduated from being a match at WrestleMania to having its own pay-per-view because we all have to have gimmick pay-per-views now. But I will say this much, they've done a much better job of promoting this show than they have some of their recent ones, including Fatal 4-Way, which I was at last month, where there was hardly any promotion for it whatsoever. What they did at the end of the show on Monday night was a little awkward, having Sheamus and John Cena essentially united as one against the Nexus, which leads me to believe, I'm almost convinced that Sheamus, if he's not the force behind Nexus, he's certainly in cahoots with them, or will be, but then again, maybe it's a swerve. So let's do a quick rundown of the matches here. There's actually two women's matches, because when you have two Money in the Bank matches, you've got a lot of pay-per-view time to fill. So you've got to have two women's matches instead of having just the requisite one. Layla against Kelly Kelly. Divas champion Alicia Fox defending against Eve Torres, who was horrible on commentary but looked damn good on Raw Monday night. Unified Tag Team titles on the line. The Hart Dynasty against Jimmy and Jey Uso. Not quite sure why. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I've missed certain parts of SmackDown and whatnot, but I don't believe the Hart Dynasty has showed up on any other show but Raw. I could have sworn that if you're the Unified Tag Team Champions, you can appear on both programs, but I don't believe that's happened yet. So, anyway, you've got your two world title matches, Rey Mysterio against Jack Swagger, Sheamus defending against John Cena in a steel cage, which, as Cena said Monday night, is intended to keep people out. I cannot think of very many WWE cage matches recently that have actually kept people out. I'm not sure why people would believe that, but to each their own. And then you have the two Money in the Bank matches. On the SmackDown side, let's see who the eight participants are here. We've got Matt Hardy, Dolph Ziggler, Christian, The Big Show, Kofi Kingston, Kane, Cody Rhodes, Dashing Cody Rhodes, and Drew McIntyre, who's probably my pick to win this whole thing. And originally was scheduled to win the Money in the Bank match. Then those visa issues popped up, and of course he got those fixed. So I'm going to throw my prediction out there. I'll go with Drew McIntyre. On the Raw side, you've got Randy Orton, John Morrison, Evan Bourne, Ted DiBiase, Chris Jericho, Edge, The Miz, and replacing, I guess it was R-Truth, who's out with a groin injury, we have Mark Henry. Why Mark Henry? Why not? I'm going to go with Evan Bourne in this match. And I say that because I know they've given Evan a bit of a push lately, which, believe it or not, John Cena is actually at least partially to thank for that. He went to bat for Evan with Vince McMahon a couple weeks back. He's been getting a push, and then, you know, he got RKO'd a couple of weeks back. He was made to look like a jobber. But he had a whole bunch of wins over Chris Jericho. He got RKO'd again on Monday night, but what an amazing spot that was. Randy Orton catching Evan Bourne in midair during his airborne 450 splash and turning it into an RKO. It was a damn impressive-looking maneuver. And it just makes me think there's been a pretty heavy focus on Evan Bourne. And maybe, you know, can I see Evan Bourne winning a world championship in WWE? It's not impossible, but it's hard for me to fathom. That doesn't mean he wouldn't win Money in the Bank and get a crack at the title. So I'm just going to go ahead and say Evan Bourne, just to be different. You know, Randy Orton could win, sure, Edge, but I'm looking for something fresh here. I'm not looking for the same old shit. And I certainly don't expect Mark Henry to walk away with that briefcase, although watching him climb to the very tippy top of that ladder would be maybe the most interesting thing on the show. But I'm going to go with Evan Bourne in that match. So, you know, it's an okay lineup. This is not a pay-per-view I'm spending $50 to watch, I can tell you that much. But, you know, good for them that they at least put some more promotion and better build to the show than they did to their last one or two pay-per-views, which, I mean, the build has been virtually non-existent for those shows. There was much ballyhoo, speaking of Raw Monday, about the fact that WWE updated, its opening montage that plays before the show opens. They took out a couple of people. I think they took Gorilla Monsoon out of there, which kind of surprised me. And they put a couple of new people in there, like Gorgeous George, which is not surprising at all, seeing as how they're working on a movie about him, WWE Films is. I think the shot of the Ultimate Warrior that was in there before, which was him flexing in the ring, was replaced by a shot of him running down the aisle. you know, obviously guys like Hogan and Flair, they took them out a long time ago. Somebody said The Rock was taken out. The Rock was still in there. I don't know who said that, but somebody sent me an email about that. They were all upset that The Rock was taken out of the video. I went back and I watched it. It looked like The Rock was in there to me. John Cena, shot of him replaced Triple H at the very end. But the biggest thing of all is that Michael Cole was added to the montage and Jim Ross's voice was removed. Jim Ross, I don't know what Jim Ross thinks. There were reports that Jim Ross was really pissed off. I'm sure he's bothered by it. I don't think he threw furniture or threw any barbecue sauce bottles around when he saw it. In fact, he tweeted that he was at the gym at the time. He didn't even know. People started texting him and he said, well, it would have been nice for somebody to tell me. Look, I am not a Michael Cole fan as an announcer. I think he'd probably make a great heel character, but as an announcer, he's not very good at all. Jim Ross is infinitely better. Jim Ross should still be calling matches. I agree. But I've got to say this. I saw Jim Ross tweet that, and later on in his blog, he kind of had a little bit of a 180, and he said, well, it doesn't bother me at all. I don't believe that for a second. I'm sure he was bothered by it. I think that first tweet, this is why Twitter can be so dangerous, is more telling than anything else. You know, he's like, basically, the message was, well, nobody told me, would have been nice, oh well. Boo fucking who? Vince McMahon does not have to tell Jim Ross. Kevin Dunn does not have to tell Jim Ross. John Laurinaitis does not have to tell Jim Ross, hey Jim, just so you know, we took your voice out of the open. They certainly don't have to ask his permission. So if he's pissed off about it, tough shit. Deal with it. They don't owe you anything. I don't agree with it. I wish they didn't take him out. But all these people saying, oh, you know, Vince McMahon is, what a bastard, really? You're going to call Vince McMahon a bastard of all things you could call Vince McMahon an asshole for? He's an asshole because, and maybe it was somebody else's decision, although it was likely something that Vince ultimately gave the okay to, but the fact that Vince ordered Jim Ross's voice taken out of the opening montage makes him an asshole above all the other awful things he's done. Really? That's the one that you point to? Get over yourself. It's not a big deal. And that's what Jim Ross says now. He says it's not a big deal. It's not. I mean, if they start scrubbing his voice from DVD releases in 24/7, that's where I think they crossed the line. They have not done that. They're not going to do that. It doesn't matter. It really isn't. It's not a big deal. But again, the more I looked at that tweet from Jim Ross, and maybe I just took it the wrong way. There's a lot of Jim Ross defenders out there. I've defended him before. I think he's fantastic at what he does. They don't owe you anything, okay? Nobody has to tell you that they're going to take your voice out of the opening montage. They don't need you to sign a fucking release form to take your voice out and put Michael Cole's voice in. So just get over yourself. The other big news of the week, which I posted on SE Scoops, as I am the webmaster, as you may recall, posted an item up about Nexus and the plans that WWE would like very much for the big payoff to be big and not to be a disappointment. And they're considering, this is not something that's been decided upon yet, but they've been toying with the idea of turning a big babyface star heel and aligning them with Nexus as part of the big payoff. And the two names that were discussed most frequently in the last week or so were Triple H and John Cena. Now, I've said before that I wish John Cena would go heel. Just imagine, it would be on par. I think it would be as epic as, quite frankly, the Hogan turn was in 96 at the Bash at the Beach for this generation. You know, that would be the equivalent of it. I don't know that Cena, when he ultimately, if he ever does turn heel, is going to start wearing suits and ties. I'm just saying the image of John Cena walking out having turned heel wearing a suit would be quite surreal. But I'd love to see Cena go heel. Unfortunately, this is one time where I hope it doesn't happen because it doesn't make any sense. You know, if you choose John Cena, unless it's one of these, well, if I can't beat them, join them type of things, it doesn't make sense. First of all, that doesn't fit Cena's character. You know, the whole never give up, never die attitude. You've got seven guys that have been beating the piss out of him for weeks, making his life hell, beating him up every chance they get, costing him the championship at Fatal 4-Way. What sense would it make for Cena to be revealed at the end as being behind the Nexus? Answer, none. It makes no sense. Begrudgingly, Triple H would actually be a much better pick. Now, Triple H, it doesn't really matter because he just had surgery on a torn tendon in his arm. He's likely out of SummerSlam, and he'll be gone probably another 2 to 3 months. So unless they're going to drag this out more and more, that injury may have put a little monkey wrench in their plans. Maybe not. You know, again, this angle's not going to end in the next couple of weeks. Maybe they drag it out beyond SummerSlam. Maybe they can drag it on until Survivor Series. I think we talked about that recently. You know, having maybe a big War Games match as a big payoff at the end or something to that end. Triple H would make a lot of sense. You know, Triple H has been out now for many months. Nobody really knows in storyline. Nobody knows what he's been doing, other than licking his wounds, obviously. And obviously, Triple H has had his share of issues in the past with John Cena. There's no question about that. And Triple H, at the end of the day, his character is just one big bastard. So Triple H also likes to surround himself with other people. You know, Triple H, when he came in, he had China. After that, he had Stephanie McMahon, was part of the whole McMahon-Helmsley regime. Of course, before that, he was part of D-Generation X and the corporate ministry. He led Evolution. He had Ric Flair in his corner. Triple H, I'm not saying he can't get over on his own, but I think he's used other people as a crutch to help his act get over the years. So Triple H surrounding himself with a bunch of younger guys, maybe leading them in a new faction, I could easily see that. And I'm not even saying that would be the worst idea in the world. Here's the part that would be the worst idea in the world. If you did this, then in theory, you're building to a Triple H John Cena match or a series of Triple H John Cena matches. I don't ever want to see Triple H and John Cena face each other again. Ever. I know it's impossible. I know it'll happen at some point. But you're building to a feud that has already been done to death. I don't want to see that again. So how do you work it? If it's Triple H, how do you avoid that? It's difficult to really conceive of how they would do that. So at the end of the day, of the two, I would go with Triple H, but I really hope that the payoff is somebody completely different. But those are the two names that were being discussed this past week. Again, the problem with Cena is that he sells so much merchandise. I mean, he is the golden goose, and you're really running a very big risk. You can turn him heel, and maybe something about a John Cena heel turn will light a fire under people, and your ratings will go up, and maybe you'll actually sell more tickets, and maybe you'll help with merchandise for other people, some of the baby faces. But it's a delicate balance. They make a lot of money off the guy. Say what you want to about John Cena, he still makes a lot of money for the company. Do you really want to voluntarily go ahead and kind of kill that? You know, when Steve Austin turned heel in 2001, which was his idea, and even now Austin says it was a bad move. I don't think Austin was ever the same again. There was a lot to like about that heel Austin character, the chicken shit champion that he was in 2001. He was just hilarious. But two really bad things came from that. Number one, those god-awful what chants, which killed the business for years and years and years, and killed the promo aspect, anyway, of the business. And number two, Austin was never the same, in my opinion. You know, I just don't think the Stone Cold character ever caught fire, ever again after that heel turn, even after he became babyface again, because, you know, you can't just snap your fingers and go back to the way things were. So, you know, that's a decision WWE has to make. I would hope they have a better name. It doesn't have to be The Rock or anybody like that, and I don't think it is, but, you know, Michael Cole. Michael Cole would actually make the most sense, but I don't think they've made up their minds yet, so it's kind of pointless to try guessing who it is. I also posted an item on SC Scoops during the week about Chris Jericho. Could he possibly be on his way out of WWE preparing for life after wrestling? He certainly has not given any indication that he wants to take another break or quit from the business. I think he still has fun doing what he does. And I think, you know, when his contract expires in September, you know, leading up to that point, and probably even right now as we speak, I'm sure WWE is trying to re-sign him or get him to sign an extension or something to that effect. The last thing WWE wants is for Chris Jericho to go to TNA. In my opinion, I don't see why they really should be all that bothered by it. If they're worried about him going to TNA and actually making an impact, no pun intended, they've got nothing to worry about, because TNA has proven time and time again, no matter how big your name is, no matter how brightly your star shines in WWE, it doesn't matter, because when you go to TNA, you maybe get a very brief, short-term boost in a rating, and then you go right back down to where you were. They look at all the names they have. Hogan, Sting, Flair, RVD, Jeff Hardy, Mr. Kennedy, you know? It hasn't made a damn bit of difference. So I wouldn't be so much worried about that. I'd be worried just about losing a talented guy like Chris Jericho, who's been the MVP of this company, or certainly one of the MVPs for this company, for the last couple of years on both Raw and SmackDown. You know, he said that he's going to be taping more episodes of that ABC game show Downfall in the fall. In October, he has a pretty extensive tour date list or schedule that was posted this past week in the UK, performing with his band Fozzy, which actually I believe includes two Monday dates. And of course, Jericho is a Raw star. And that month, they're also building to the Bragging Rights pay-per-view, which Jericho was a big part of last year. He'd probably be a big part of it again this year. How him being on the road and on tour with Fozzy overseas for 2 or 3 weeks straight would impact that, I don't know. Would he get permission to go do that and then come back? I think if you look at the schedule, I think it ends the day before the Bragging Rights pay-per-view. So how do you build? You know, how does that work? I don't know of Vince McMahon ever giving anybody that sort of exemption, you know. So I don't know. We'll see. I hope Jericho doesn't leave. He has given no indication which way he's leaning at this point. But his contract is going to be up in the next 2 to 2.5 months. And he's got a lot planned for October. And those plans so far center around everything except wrestling. So we'll see how that ends up. This Florida promotion, which I also posted about, I was very busy posting during this week. All we know is this. There's a new wrestling promotion being started down in Florida. It's being financed by somebody who has some money. He has a connection to the Wilpon family. Of course, the Wilpon family, owners of the New York Mets baseball franchise. And I have to just clarify here. It was never said that the Mets or the Wilpon family were funding this wrestling company or starting a wrestling company. Not true. Never, ever going to happen. This is a member of the family with the last name Wilpon who's doing his own thing and putting some money behind this project. That's all this is. Again, what makes it unique is that most wrestling startups and indie promotions, they don't have the sort of financial backing that this one will seemingly have, at least right out of the gate. This thing loses money 3, 6, 9 months down the road. Who's to say that Milton Wilpon is going to want to continue to lose money on an operation like that? Although, you know, if he can make money off it, and it doesn't have to be a whole national thing. Maybe he runs a little regional wrestling promotion that makes some money, and he's happy. I don't know. Without a solid TV deal, it doesn't matter. This thing is not going to get off the ground. It's not going to go anywhere. You need television. You don't need pay-per-view. You need TV. And it's way too early in the process to even speculate if they have a TV deal. Maybe they're in discussions. Maybe they're not. We know that they've already signed between 30 and 40 wrestlers. They've forced them to sign confidentiality agreements because they don't want hardly anything to get out. We know a couple of the names that have been contacted include Shane Douglas and Sabu, I believe Scorpio. Sean Waltman is one of the few that we do know who are already under contract, as well as Vader. That's right, Big Van Vader, former WCW champion, WWE superstar. He's been, I believe, running his own promotion, working in Japan the last couple of years. He's done some tag matches recently with his son Jesse, who Jim Ross has spoken fondly about in his blogs. Vader has signed with the promotion, believe it or not. Vader's actually lost a fair amount of weight. I haven't seen a picture of him recently, but I was told, and Jim Ross has talked about this as well, that Vader has lost some weight. I believe he's still well over 300 pounds, but I mean, at one point, Vader had really let his weight just spiral out of control to where I think he was close to, if not over, 500 pounds. In fact, if you remember a couple of years ago, actually, this would have been back, I think, in 05. They were trying to get Steve Austin to do a pay-per-view match at Taboo Tuesday against Jonathan Coachman. So think about this for a second. Steve Austin, who even then had not wrestled the match in 2 or 3 years. He was retired. You know, if you're going to do an angle like that with one of the biggest draws of all time, you would want to build that up for a big pay-per-view match at like a WrestleMania or a SummerSlam. WWE was going to have Steve Austin's big comeback match at a shitty throwaway pay-per-view show against The Coach. So, of course, Steve Austin, just days before the show, got hurt, quote-unquote, called WWE, said that he hurt his back or something moving furniture. Even Vince McMahon came on Raw, and that's the exact excuse that he gave, not because they made that up. That was the excuse that Steve Austin gave to them. Now, was he bullshitting? Probably. I don't blame him for doing that. So they had a scramble to come up with a replacement match for the pay-per-view, and so they plugged Batista in there to feud with Coach, and Coach brought in Goldust, who had not been on TV for a couple of years, and Vader, who had not been seen on WWE television since 1998. And Vader did not have a very good night, because you could find the video on YouTube. It's actually kind of embarrassing. After they beat down Batista, the Coach climbs out of the ring, Goldust climbs out of the ring, and then you see Vader climbing through the ropes, and he climbs through the ropes, and as he lands on the floor, he falls backwards. You can hear him screaming and cursing off camera. The coach goes to kind of help him up. It was a very embarrassing faux pas by Vader, but he's lost a little bit of weight. He signed on with this new Florida promotion. They have a different approach, supposedly, to pro wrestling that's more legit sports-oriented. None of the bullshit you would see on TNA or the bullshit you would see on Raw. There's just a greater focus on the competitive aspect of pro wrestling. It's not going to be work shoots or anything like the old, you know, rings promotion in Japan or anything like that. But, you know, we'll see. It's an interesting concept. But again, without TV, I can't get excited about this because, first of all, I'm in New York. They're in Florida. So if they don't have a national TV deal, it does me no good. But they've, you know, we have to see what talent they have. We have to see, you know, what name they give the promotion. I mean, they're so early on in the development of this thing, they don't even have a name figured out yet. So that's what we know so far. And as we get more news or read about more news, if it's reliable, we'll certainly post about it on SC Scoops. And maybe I'll talk a little bit more about it in the weeks to come. Now, speaking of Vader, I just wanted to mention this. I mentioned on Twitter.com/Solomonster, cheap plug. Last night was a rare, quiet Friday night, so I figured, wow, I get to watch an entire episode of SmackDown, you know, in its original airing. I won't have to go online and watch it. And, of course, they had a Yankee game on, our local My Network affiliate. So SmackDown was delayed until, I think, 11 o'clock at night. I was passed out by then. So I ordered in some Chinese food, and I decided, let's see what's on WWE 24/7, because I pay a subscription fee for this thing each month. It's not much. I mean, in my area, I think it varies based on your cable provider. In my area, it's $7 a month, and it's absolutely worth it. It's, if you have, I've said this before, if you are a wrestling fan and you have access to WWE 24/7 in your area, pay the money for it, because even if it was $10 a month, it would be worth every penny of it. Unfortunately, I'm not around so much. There's so much stuff I miss each and every month, and I don't have DVR. I'm not recording this, so I can just imagine all the great content I've missed these last couple of months. But this month so happens to be Ric Flair month, or at least he's the featured legend in the legend section, which is kind of ironic. And just goes to show you that Vince McMahon probably has no idea what's going on with 24/7. So they have a couple of Ric Flair matches. They have his Hall of Fame documentary, a bio on him, I think his Hall of Fame induction. They show, I believe it's Ric Flair in his debut match from 1973, a Ric Flair-Kerry Von Erich match from 1992 WWF from Barcelona, Spain, when Von Erich was the Texas Tornado. A Ric Flair-Kurt Hennig match from WCW Monday Nitro. I believe it was Nitro in 97. I haven't watched that one yet. And they have a Ric Flair match against Vader from WCW Starrcade, 1993. Now, a little bit of history here for you. Ric Flair, as you may recall, had a bit of a conflict with Jim Herd, who was the president of World Championship Wrestling. This was back in 1991. And Flair left the company. And he took the belt with him. There was a whole big dispute. Flair talks about it on his Ultimate Ric Flair Collection DVD. He talked about it in his book. It's been well documented. I'm sure Ric Flair wasn't completely innocent. There's two sides to every story. But basically, Jim Herd was somebody that was hired by the Turner Brass to run WCW, to run a wrestling promotion, having had no previous experience running a wrestling promotion or having anything to do with one. In fact, I think he was a higher-up for Pizza Hut, as Ric Flair likes to fondly point out. So that was the extent to which Jim Herd had any familiarity with running a wrestling promotion. Basically, he had his head up his ass. So Flair leaves, takes the big gold belt, and goes to WWF in late 1991. And, you know, to Vince McMahon's credit, he did not do with Flair what he had done many, many times before with people that came over from the NWA or from WCW. You know, Harley Race, who was this big, legit tough guy, multiple-time world champion, came to WWF and was saddled with this horrible king gimmick where he had to walk around wearing a crown. Dusty Rhodes came over to WWF and was given that horrible polka dot gimmick, although he made it work, but it was meant to embarrass him. So Ric Flair comes in, and you would think they're going to do the same thing. And, you know, to Vince McMahon's credit, he obviously had a certain level of respect for Ric Flair because Flair became a main event player. You know, he won the 1992 Royal Rumble, and my favorite all-time Rumble match, became champion, was featured in a headline match at WrestleMania 8 against Randy Savage. Now, after that, he really didn't do much. He kind of toiled in these meaningless feuds. He didn't even wrestle at Wembley Stadium at SummerSlam that year. He had a run-in. Flair apparently had some sort of gentleman's agreement with Vince McMahon when he first signed with the company that said if at any point Vince wanted to move him out of the main event picture and down to the mid-card, Flair had the option to walk out and leave if he wanted to and go back to WCW. And shockingly enough, Vince McMahon obviously agreed to that because that's exactly what ended up happening. Flair saw the writing on the wall. He was, or was told that he was being moved lower on the card. He wanted to get the hell out of there. And, you know, he wrestled in a Loser Leaves Town match on Raw against Kurt Hennig. This was in January of 93. He still wrestled after that a couple of matches for WWF on the, I think there was a European tour. But by February, Flair was in WCW. Now, he couldn't wrestle for them for a certain period of time. But to get around this issue, they had Flair start hosting these segments called A Flair for the Gold, these interview segments. Anyway, by the end of the year, they were able to start pushing the angle where Flair was going to compete for the World Championship. And it all built to Starrcade, big match between him and Big Van Vader. Now, it's kind of unfortunate that some people are not familiar with Vader's work outside of his run in the WWF in the late 90s, because Vader in the WWF, for the most part, sucked a cock. Okay, Vader, there's no other way to put it, I'm sorry, but he just did not have a very good run in WWF. In fact, the best thing they may have done with him was his second night in the company. He made his debut at the Rumble in 96. He got eliminated, but he beat up a whole bunch of people. The next night on Raw, he beat up Gorilla Monsoon, who was the interim acting president of the World Wrestling Federation at the time. And that's what Vader was. You know, he was a big bully and very menacing. And after that, they didn't do much with him. You know, he had a pretty good match at SummerSlam with Shawn Michaels, which he lost. And he never really did anything after that. Now, if you go back and watch Vader's work in the late 80s, early 90s, when he was working in Japan, there's that infamous video on YouTube. I forget now who he was in the ring with. It was a match in Japan where his eyeball didn't fall out. I mean, if you go back and watch the video, basically his eye or the lid of his eye was popped out. He kept wrestling. He had to rip the mask off. It was really sick stuff if you could find it on YouTube. I know there's tons of videos on there showing it. He was a monster, and even in WCW, he beat the fuck out of people. People didn't like working with Vader, and it's no wonder why. But the thing is, as big as he was, because Vader was always a big guy, but he truly was, in his heyday, one of the best big men in the business. He'll go down as one of the best of all time, because he was very agile, very quick, very brutal, very hard-hitting. He wanted his matches to look and feel real, and they did, because in large part, when it came to those punches, they were. You may recall, some of you who have been wrestling fans for quite some time, the Joe Thurman incident, who was, you know, Joe Thurman was a jobber who basically had his back broken on a powerbomb by Vader. I believe it was on a WCW Saturday Night show. But Vader had some really great matches with Mick Foley, with Ric Flair, with Sting, especially with Sting. They had a very long program in 92 for the title. They had strap matches. They had really, really good matches. The Foley-Vader stuff was maybe some of the most brutal stuff I've ever seen. I think it's documented on Foley's DVD, Hard Knocks and Cheap Pops, the first one that they did. I have that here somewhere. Mick Foley's Greatest Hits, where it was an infamous match on WCW Saturday Night in 92, where Vader punched him into oblivion. I mean, he just turned his face into mush to the point where WCW had to edit it. Because there was so much blood, and they couldn't show all of the brutality. Mick had the original footage, and he actually put it on his DVD, so it's just really wicked stuff to go back and watch. So, for those of you saying, yeah, he worked with Ric Flair, so it's no wonder he had a great match, just putting it out there to prove to you that it wasn't just Ric Flair that he had great matches with. The build-up to this match, oh my God! It was not featured on 24/7, but after I watched the match last night, which I've seen before. It's not like I haven't seen the match before, but that was the featured match. So I had my Chinese food, and I watched Ric Flair vs. Vader. They don't show you the build-up, but I went on YouTube afterwards and watched the build-up, and there's this one video that I linked to on my Twitter page a couple of hours ago with this great piece of business. They show Vader arriving at the arena, which was actually in Charlotte, so they were in Flair country. and they show Vader arriving at the building with Harley Race to start, you know, training and stretching and all that stuff, preparing for the match, making it really feel like something special. They really had that big match, big fight feel to it. And they had this awesome thing where they're at Ric Flair's home in Charlotte. And I think the show's already on the air, but I guess because they're in Charlotte, maybe he didn't live that far from the building. So they're on the air during the show, and they're showing Ric Flair in a tuxedo getting ready to leave his house. And he's hugging his kids, and he's saying goodbye to his wife, and everybody's being all emotional. You know, Gene Okerlund is there with him, and Gene's just standing there watching this. And Gene, at one point, excuses himself. He goes, all right, I'll let you say goodbye to your family. As though Flair is saying goodbye to them for the last time. You know, like he's going into this great fight that he might not survive. Flair leaves, says goodbye to his family. They get in the limo. Him and Gene are talking, very low-key. Flair's not being over the top. He's not yelling and screaming and bleeding or anything like that. Very subdued, but very believable. You know, and Flair said, look, I signed the contract. I knew what I was getting myself into. I've got to do this. I've got to do this for myself. This was awesome. This was just phenomenal stuff. And then the match itself was all kinds of awesome. Just a great, great match. At one point, Vader comes off the second turnbuckle on the inside, and I don't know what he was going for. I don't know if he was trying for a double axe handle or if he changed his mind in mid-move, but he basically just kind of came down and hit Flair in the face with a fist. And Flair wasn't very happy about it because you could tell that's when Flair started bleeding. Flair didn't bleed from the head. This is one of those rare matches where Flair didn't bleed from the head, but he was bleeding from the mouth. And that he had to be busted open or have a tooth knocked out hard way on that one. Vader beat the fuck out of him. And as I recall, I don't remember if Flair talks about it in his book. I know Harley Race has said, maybe in his book, he had told Flair at one point. I think Flair maybe was on the outside or he was down and Harley Race was in Vader's corner. And Harley went up to him at one point and said, you know, fight back or else he won't have any respect for you. Because that's what Vader was. In real life, Vader was, when he got in that ring, he was a bully. And the only way that he was ever going to respect you, or at least not beat you up so hard anymore, was if you fought back and said, look, motherfucker, you're not going to beat me up like that. I'm not a rag doll. I'm going to fight back. And that's what Flair started doing. Flair went after him. He was chopping the shit out of him. He was punching him. They were really laying it into each other. And, you know, Flair went for the figure four at one point. Harley Race interfered. You know, Flair went for a pinfall towards the end of the match. Race climbed up to the top rope, jumped off. Flair moved. Race landed on Vader. Then the referee is like, well, what the fuck is Harley Race doing in the ring? Shoves him out of the ring. Race falls out onto the ramp, because, again, that's where Eric Bischoff got the idea from. WCW had the ramp way back then. The finish kind of came out of nowhere, but I actually thought it was a good finish. I like that about it. It wasn't your predictable finish. It kind of came out of nowhere like you would see in a real fight, whether it's a UFC fight or a boxing match or what have you. Flair came off the ropes, hit Vader with a forearm, just rocked him a little bit, chopped him four times, ran back into the ropes, and when Flair comes off, Vader just... You know, Vader didn't have to do much because he was such a big guy. He was like a brick wall. So all Vader had to do was throw his arms up in the air and just kind of thrust his body at Flair, and it was like Flair ran into a wall. Flair fell down. Vader hurt his midsection. He kind of clutched his stomach, turned around, and when he turned around, Flair got right back up, grabbed Vader's leg. So Vader basically tripped and fell backwards over Flair, and Flair just kind of rolled him up for the 1-2-3. That was it. And the place just came unglued. I mean, yeah, it's Charlotte, so Flair was going to get a big pop no matter what, but this was a reaction that you don't find... I can't even say you don't find it much at all. You don't find it at all in wrestling anymore. And that's what struck me about this match, as great as it was. And it wasn't even the best match I've ever seen, but it was just a really, really, really good match. What struck me about it and made me kind of depressed, I guess you would say, as still very much a wrestling fan today, watching this match from 1993 and comparing it to wrestling in 2010. Now, again, the business is very different now than it was back then, so it's hard to compare. But it just makes me wonder, why can't we see more of this in 2010? Forget the brutality aspect of it. You know, I don't want these guys to really go in there and hurt each other. Although I would appreciate it if they at least tried to make things look a little more real. I mean, you know, when John Cena throws a punch, God bless John Cena, his punches still look like shit. You know, maybe John Cena should get to the building really mega early one day and get in the ring with Jerry Lawler, because Jerry Lawler probably throws punches better than anybody in that company. But just the emotion, you know, the build-up to the match. They made it feel so special. so big. And Starrcade, in many ways, was kind of like the WrestleMania of WCW back then, only not. But why can't we get buildups like that for matches that aren't on WrestleMania? You know, we're going to be heading into SummerSlam soon. Think back to The Rock and Brock Lesnar from SummerSlam 2002. That match and that pay-per-view did very well, far better even than people expected, in large part because of how well that match was promoted. They promoted that match like a real sporting event, like a real fight. You know, they showed The Rock training and running laps. They showed Brock Lesnar doing squats and all that sort of thing. And it worked. It can work in pro wrestling. You know, 2002 was a long time ago, but it really wasn't. It wasn't that long ago. It wasn't as long as 1993. Everything about the build-up, the way the match was structured, the psychology, the crowd reaction, you know, why crowds don't react, isn't it obvious? I mean, you don't really give them anything to really get on their feet for like that anymore. That was kind of depressing, but it was still a good time. That was a really good choice on my part to watch that match over Ric Flair and Chris Taylor, for example, which was one of the other featured matches, which... Yeah, you look at Ric Flair back in the 70s, like pre-plane crash in 75, he looks nothing. I mean, just nothing like he looked, even 10 years later. You know, Flair, I know Flair has admitted that he was on steroids, although he claims he was never on steroids until the Steamboat feud in 89, which I'm not so sure about that, but he was just a big guy. I mean, he was well over 300 pounds, much bigger, much thicker frame. Just very weird to watch Ric Flair from the 70s as compared to Ric Flair in the 90s, for example. So, anyway, if you have 24/7, if you haven't checked out that match, if you have and you haven't seen it in a couple of years, go back and watch it. Flair vs. Vader from 93. Or you could find it on YouTube, I guess. But definitely watch it. And let's compare notes. I mean, maybe you guys have different thoughts on that than I do, but that was what struck me, comparing the two eras of wrestling then and now. That's a big part of what's missing from wrestling these days. You know, being emotionally invested in a match, in a feud like that, making it feel special, making it feel like, oh, I want to spend $50, you know, or $45 or whatever it is in HD to see this guy beat up the other guy, you know, or this guy really might get killed going in there against this, you know, this guy. So anyway, those are my thoughts on Flair versus Vader. All right, so let's bring into the mailbag here. I got a couple of good questions this week, as always, from you guys, since you guys are awesome. K-Fist, from, you may recognize K-Fist as a commenter on the posts on SEScoops.com. I had a question here. And basically the question is this. Given the popularity of UFC, we kind of talked about this a little bit last week, but do I think companies like WWE would benefit from using the UFC model of marketing, like their own version of a countdown special, for example, to each pay-per-view? Absolutely. And WWE used to do this many, many years ago. In fact, when I was, a young lad watching the World Wrestling Federation, they would sometimes have a SummerSlam or Survivor Series type special. But typically it was just a couple of matches that were taped in advance that USA Network would air. And it really, you know, they stuck some promos in there. It wasn't anything even comparable to what UFC does these days. But again, consider that that was 1990 and 1992. But for WWE to do something similar to the UFC countdown shows, where they focus on one or two big matches coming up on pay-per-view, would be phenomenal. But here's the problem with that. You can only do that for shows like the Rumble, SummerSlam, Survivor Series, WrestleMania, maybe a couple of other ones, because there are a couple of spots on the schedule each year where there's literally only 2 weeks, maybe three, of time to promote certain pay-per-views. I think the Gap, for example, in September, I don't even know what their September show is anymore since they went and changed everything, and I know Breaking Point is not being brought back, but the Hell in a Cell show that they have, I think between the Hell in a Cell and the pay-per-view before that, there may only be 2 weeks. You cannot possibly put together a countdown special that's going to mean anything to the buy rate if you have 2 weeks to promote that show. It just doesn't work that way, so... But could they do it a couple of times a year? Would it help? I think it absolutely would help. But here's the thing. I don't think WWE can do it. I don't think that Kevin Dunn and his team are capable of putting together a show like that because they don't know how to do it. The only way they know how to do TV is the way they've been doing it for years. I'm convinced of this. I am convinced that the only reason they have not changed the way they do television and done things like this is because they don't know how. As great as they are, as great as their production values are and all that stuff, and their video packages, I don't know that Kevin Dunn and his team are capable or have the mindset to put together a show like that, because they're so stuck in their own little bubble that they only know one way to put on wrestling, and that's the way we see every week. So there you go. I really don't know what you do to change that, because Kevin Dunn ain't going nowhere. Now, as far as TNA, which is Kay Fist's next question here, would TNA benefit? Forget the marketing aspect. Forget TNA borrowing the UFC marketing aspect. The marketing is a big thing TNA needs to do a better job at. But I think they should apply it to their creative, and I give you the best example I could possibly give you. 2 years ago, maybe it was 3 years ago by now, many of you will recall, Kurt Angle and Samoa Joe, they had a cage match at Lockdown. I believe it was Lockdown. And they decided that for this match, they're going to take a different approach. They're going to take a more MMA-style, realistic approach to promoting the match and the match itself. It was just a very different style. And all I remember is that that buy rate for that particular TNA pay-per-view was the biggest buy rate they ever did. So what did TNA go ahead and do after that? And by the way, you can thank Dutch Mantel. I name-dropped Dutch Mantel last week as maybe somebody creatively who could help TNA. He used to work for them. He got fired when the whole Jeff Jarrett fiasco with Karen Angle and Dixie Carter, you know, sent Jarrett home. Dutch Mantel was a Jeff Jarrett ally, and he got kind of caught in the crossfire. But that was actually Dutch Mantel's idea, or at least he takes credit for it. Taking that approach with the whole Kurt Angle Samoa Joe thing. So that pay-per-view did the best numbers and the best buy rate that they ever did up to that point. And since. So what did TNA go ahead and do? They went right back to doing things the way that they always did. Now, you can't do that with every single feud. I get that. You can have some undercard underneath feuds, but they never bothered doing it with any other feud or any other match ever again. That was the one time that they did it. And I'm not counting that bullshit with AJ Styles and Frank Trigg from a couple of years ago, okay? That's completely different. That right there encapsulates everything I've been saying about TNA. Because even when they do something right, they still fuck it up. I could just see the people backstage at TNA. When those numbers came in, they look at those numbers and they go to themselves. Now let's just assume you had some people politically who were against the idea of doing things that way. Or maybe Dutch Mantel had some enemies, and so they didn't want to make him look good. So imagine this meeting backstage, if you will, when these numbers come in and Dixie Carter is sitting there and Vince Russo and whoever. And they're, you know, again, Vince Russo probably was not a big fan of that either, because something like that requires less writing. And when you have less writing, the writers feel threatened because you're taking away their livelihood. This is the way they think. Same thing with the WWE writers, by the way. So I could just envision this backstage meeting in TNA where they're looking at the numbers and they're going, wow, these numbers are quite higher than they're used to being. And other people piping up in the meeting and saying, well, you know, I'm sure it was a typo. I'm sure that's bullshit. You know, it's just an aberration. And Dixie Carter just sitting there and going, oh, okay. Because, again, she knows nothing about the wrestling business. So, yes, TNA would definitely benefit from this. And I think if Paul Heyman came in, and again, after that angle on Thursday, I don't have very high hopes for that to happen. But you never know. I mean, if they give Heyman everything he wants, because Heyman is still demanding essentially full control of the company. He wants the power to hire and fire whoever he wants. He wants to bring in his own team. You know, none of this political bullshit. He wants to be the authority backstage in TNA, and Dixie Carter won't let him do that. So until that happens, Paul Heyman ain't coming in. But if he did, I think this is the way that you would start to see more of an influence like this over that product. So there is some hope for TNA. There's very little hope, but there is a little bit. So to answer your question, both companies would benefit from that. Seth writes in to back me up here. Dear Solomonster, I was once a TNA mark. That said, TNA is a total piece of shit these days, for lack of a better term. I personally missed 2005 to 2008, those years of TNA, where the X Division was great and really featured. It worked great with talent that would not work in WWE, like Joe, of course. WWE probably wouldn't give him a second look. And a lot of the smaller wrestlers. However, these days, TNA is made up of WWE rejects and cast-offs, which has killed TNA. Basically, I just wanted to let you know that you are not alone in thinking TNA is garbage. Well, thank you. Craig in Texas writes in, very succinct question here. Dear Solomonster, do you think it is in Sting's best interest to go to WWE while he still has some sort of popularity amongst the general wrestling audience? Well, I think Sting, in the best interest of his wallet and his checking account, should absolutely go to WWE. He should get his DVD, he should get his Hall of Fame induction, get a WrestleMania payoff, and then ride off into the sunset. Mr. 5150, if that is your real name. Oh, actually, he has his real name here. Sorry about that. Marcel from Chicago writes in. He's a listener of the Sound Off since episode 30-something, and not the TV show. A couple of different observations here. Have you noticed that Alex Riley from NXT Season 2 looks a lot like he and The Miz could be brothers? I have noticed that, in fact. But not because they look alike, more because they're just very obnoxious and annoying. I don't know about you, Solomonster, but if this ECW Rebirth or 9 happens to work by the grace of God, Jesus, and Mary, I think I'll be in the dying days again of WCW with Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff. Well, just so you know, this is a little Solomonster footnote here. Hulk Hogan is against the idea of Paul Heyman coming into TNA. Just so you know, which I know Hogan did have back surgery recently, which is true. That's a shoot. That is legit. But I think there's more to the story here with him and Bischoff not being at the tapings the last couple of weeks. I know Bischoff went on his blog, and he got a little bitchy and a little pissy about the wrestling media. He said, I was on a family vacation, it's my anniversary, or blah, 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 blah. Let me tell you something. Were it not for everything that's being talked about right now, and Eric Bischoff is a smart guy. He's well aware of the fact that Dixie Carter is practically on bended knee trying to get Paul Heyman into this company, because she's under a lot of pressure right now to make big changes. There's more to the story here than just Bischoff going on a vacation. I don't give a shit what he says. So you may not have to deal with Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff much longer if Dixie Carter gets her way. And lastly here from Marcel, let's see here. Nobody wants to really see Abyss be the quote-unquote hitman for the ECW guys. Well, I guess that's out the window since they attacked him, but why in the hell did he try to attack RVD, the king of ECW? Well, Marcel, why ask why? Daryl writes in to the podcast, Solomonster, been a listener since episode 1. Wow. I just have a quick question for you. What are your thoughts on the Big Show? Me, personally, I think he's funny, has a lot of agility for a big man, and good promo work. He stepped into the role of being Jericho's partner when Edge got injured very nicely, and sometimes I believe he is underrated. Just wanted to get your thoughts on the big guy and whether or not he should be world champion again sometime in the near future. I don't think Big Show should be world champion ever again. Not because I hate Big Show. I love Big Show. And I'm very much looking forward to his movie, Knucklehead, coming out in the next couple of months. Because I think, like you said, he's a very funny, very witty guy. Big Show doing comedy is always entertaining. We've seen Big Show as the big giant monster so many times over the years that I'm okay seeing kind of lighthearted, funny Big Show. As world champion, though, lighthearted, funny Big Show won't sell tickets or pay-per-views. That's why I say he shouldn't be world champion again. Big Show, by the way, used to be a lot more fit and a lot more agile than he is now. So, considering his time in the business, you know, giants unfortunately don't last very long. I know he had his issue with the his pituitary gland addressed when he was much younger, in his teens, I believe. But still, he's a very big guy. You know, his proportions are very big. You don't know how long he's going to live. He's even commented on this before. You know, you worry about things like that. Look at Andre the Giant. I mean, he never had his pituitary issue addressed, but, you know, he made it to the age of 47, which was way, way older than doctors even thought he would make it. And he's commented before. He's worried about that. You know, eventually his body is going to start breaking down. He hasn't reached that point yet. He took a couple of years off. When he left WWE, he was going to do boxing, and that fell through, but he really lost a lot of weight. Unfortunately, he's also put some of that weight back on. He's still more svelte than he was. If you go back and watch Raw, for example, in 2004 or 2005, just look at Big Show's face. I mean, he had all that. I don't know if it was water or what it was, but he had this humongously fat face, and his gut was just out to here. I mean, not quite as big as Matt Hardy's gut, but he's still a very big gut nonetheless. And Big Show is in better shape than he was a couple of years ago. But that being said, if you go back and watch a giant match from WCW back in 96, Big Show back then was doing kip-ups. he was in much better shape. But then again, he was younger. You could say that for anybody. When you're younger, you're going to be a lot more svelte and, you know, in much better shape. That goes for anybody. But I like Big Show. Sebastian in Birmingham writes in, "Dear Solomon, with the death of Yankees owner George Steinbrenner, I started thinking what might happen if Vince McMahon, well, not if, but when Vince McMahon eventually dies. What do you think WWE and wrestling overall will be like after the passing of Mr. McMahon?" Well, I don't want to think too much about that. I think about that from time to time because Vince is getting up there in years, and it worries me because for all the bad things you could say about Vince McMahon, the guy, at least more so than any other promoter, including a certain one of a female persuasion down south, at least Vince McMahon has somewhat of a clue. He has a proven track record as being able to run a wrestling organization. Shane McMahon is out of the company pretty much altogether, which leaves Stephanie and Triple H in charge when Vince ultimately kicks the bucket. Triple H has pretty good acumen for the business, but, you know, running the entire company, you know, I don't know about that. I'm a little concerned. Well, let's hope what Vince says is true, that he's going to live forever. Zach, listeners in Sound Off 50, writes into your Solo Monster. Saw your article on SE Scoops that said WWE was thinking about having Triple H or John Cena go heel and lead the Nexus. What are your thoughts on that? I would rather have Cena turn heel. Haven't seen heel Cena in quite some time. Would love to see it. But if they choose Triple H or Cena to be the leader, that would basically spell doom for the young guys career-wise. They're doing good and being noticed for their individual skills. So I would be worried about the Nexus guys becoming overshadowed by the big stars. What are your thoughts? Well, I talked about Cena and Triple H potentially going heel earlier in the show, but as far as a big name overshadowing the Nexus guys, that's just comes with the territory, you know? That's something that is going to be unavoidable, I think. Unless it's a Chris Jericho, for example. Jericho, I don't think, would overshadow those guys at all. Whereas a Triple H or a Cena or a Rock or an Austin or somebody of that magnitude certainly would take a lot of the focus off of, you know, the Heath Slaters of the world and the Michael Tarvers. Michael Cole certainly would not. He's a safe choice. But I think, you know, certainly Zach makes a point. And last but not least, Art writes into the podcast. "You're a Solo Monster fan for 2 years. I listen at night when cooking dinner." How about that? "Can anyone say no to these awful promos? I can't imagine John Cena being scared by a firing or a suspension. P.S. I know how to fix TNA by using a dream sequence and taking them off the air until they sign Paul Heyman." You know, it's interesting. John Cena is in a position where I agree. I mean, look, you and I don't work backstage. Maybe John Cena, look, he's a company guy. We know that. Some people wrote in and they said they were watching Raw Monday night when Cena came out to do that opening promo, and there was, as always, just a couple of god-awful, corny fucking lines in this promo, and they could have sworn Cena was rolling his eyes or something. Like, Cena has to know this material is absolute shit. But he's a company guy, and he doesn't say anything, and maybe he does. Maybe he says something and gets shot down. I agree. I find it hard to believe. Here's the thing to keep in mind. You know, back during the Attitude Era, for example, maybe one of the few good things you'll hear me say about Vince Russo, when he was writing, you know, he would give bullet points and things of that nature to at least the top guys and just let them go out there and cut their own promos. That's the way it was always done. And that, by the way, is the other thing about that Flair-Vader match and the build-up back in 93. None of that shit was scripted word for word. Again, you had an idea of what you were going to talk about. But when Ric Flair is sitting in that limo, heading to his impending doom against Vader, sitting there talking to Gene Okerlund, you know, at no point during that interview, at no point during that segment did I think to myself, man, Flair, that just sounds scripted. That sounds phony. That sounds rehearsed. It sounded real. And that's what's missing from wrestling these days as well. That sense of realism where promos are concerned. John Cena is in a position where if he were handed a piece of paper by one of the writers, by Brian Gewirtz or whoever it is, he could probably look at it, laugh, throw it away, and go do his own stuff. That's what Rock and Austin used to do. In fact, Steve Austin was famous for looking at that stuff and basically laughing and throwing it in the fucking trash because he was the top guy and he knew, you know, what are they going to do to me? And he knew probably that shit they were writing for them would kill him. So you know, Russo and stuff would at least give bullet points sometimes, although in other situations they would write certain things, and Austin would simply say, fuck this, I'm not doing it. And The Rock, too. The Rock would get a kick out of it. The Rock would laugh uproariously, and then he would go right out there and do exactly whatever he wanted to do. Good for him. I guess John Cena either just is too afraid, or I don't know why he doesn't do that. You would think Cena, and even Triple H of all people, even Triple H, when he cuts promos, will sometimes have really awful lines that he can't possibly think are good. But, you know, they have a system in place now. They're a TV show. They're entertainment. They're not professional wrestling. That's what you get when you run an entertainment company and you run a TV show, not a wrestling show. You have scripts, and you have to stick to the script, and that's what John Cena does. Apparently, he doesn't have brass balls, which is too bad for all of us, because we have to sit and suffer through those awful promos week after week. I'll tell you one thing that's not awful, though. Your questions. The mailbag. TheSolomonster@gmail.com is the email address. Still the best way to get your questions answered and read on the air, so email me there. Twitter.com/Solomonster. We are well over 550-some-odd followers now, and hopefully you're one of them. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is the Facebook page. Friend me on there. We got some great stuff posted, including a link to just a fantastic YouTube video that somebody put together. The editing is actually, it's really great and really awful all at the same time, but it's a video that depicts LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh, who now all play for the Miami Heat. They're all on the same team. And basically, their faces transposed over the faces of Hulk Hogan, Scott Hall, and Kevin Nash at the Bash at the Beach 1996 when Hogan did his infamous heel turn. And they even have an appearance in there by David Stern, the commissioner of the NBA, and the Cleveland Cavaliers mascot. Funny, funny stuff. I laughed out loud when I saw that. So definitely go on there, check it out, leave a comment. All in good fun. And of course, if you are not subscribed to the podcast on iTunes, it's free. It doesn't cost you anything. As soon as a new show goes up, you get it automatically downloaded. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to lift a finger. So definitely subscribe if you are a fan of The Sound Off. And I'm sure everybody listening is a fan of The Sound Off, because you wouldn't have listened for an hour and 20-some-odd minutes unless you were. So I thank you for that. So that's going to do it. Sound Off 118 is on tap for next weekend. Until next time, be well. As always, stay safe. We'll see you right back here next week. Take it easy, guys.
You've been listening to The Solomonster.
You know, I really just don't understand what they're doing.
Anybody agree with me out there? I mean, anybody. Come on, throw me a bone here.
Probably the single dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
God, I love this business.
On SE Scoops.